and called out to him as they crossed the castle yard, but Ned ignored them in his haste. He would have run, but he was still the king's hand, and a hand must keep his dignity. He was aware of the eyes that followed him, and the muttered voices wondering what he would do. The castle was a modest holding, a half-day's ride south of the Trident. The royal party had made themselves the uninvited guests of its lord, Sir Raymond Darry, while the hunt for Arya and the butcher's boy was conducted on both sides of the river. They were not welcome visitors. Sir Raymond lived under the king's peace, but his family had fought beneath Rhaegar's dragon banners at the Trident, and his three older brothers had died there, a truth neither Robert nor Sir Raymond had forgotten. With king's men, Darry men, Lannister men, and Stark men all crammed into a castle far too small for them, tensions burned hot and heavy. The king had appropriated Sir Raymond's audience chamber, and that was where Ned found them. The room was crowded when he burst in. Too crowded, he thought. Left alone, he and Robert might have been able to settle the matter amicably. Robert was slumped in Darry's high seat at the far end of the room, his face closed and sullen. Cersei Lannister and her son stood beside him. The queen had her hand on Joffrey's shoulder. Thick, silken bandages still covered the boy's arm. Arya stood in the centre of the room, alone but for Jorah Cassel. Every eye upon her. "Arya!" Ned called out loudly. He went to her, his boots ringing on the stone floor. When she saw him, she cried out and began to sob. Ned went to one knee and took her in his arms. She was shaking.
"I'm sorry," she sobbed. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
"I know," he said. She felt so tiny in his arms, nothing but a scrawny little girl. It was hard to see how she had caused so much trouble. "Are you hurt?"
"No."
Her face was dirty, and her tears left pink tracks down her cheeks.
"Hungry some. I ate some berries, but there was nothing else."
"We'll feed you soon enough," Ned promised. He rose to face the king. "What is the meaning of this?" His eyes swept the room, searching for friendly faces. But for his own men, they were few enough. Sir Raymond Darry guarded his look well. Lord Renly wore a half-smile that might mean anything, and Earl Sir Barristan was grave. The rest were Lannister men, and hostile. Their only good fortune was that both Jaime Lannister and Sandor Clegane were missing, leading searches north of the Trident. "Why was I not told that my daughter had been found?" Ned demanded, his voice ringing. "Why was she not brought to me at once?" He spoke to Robert, but it was Cersei Lannister who answered. "How dare you speak to your king in that manner?" At that the king stood. "Quiet, woman!" he snapped. He straightened in his seat. "I'm sorry, Ned. I never meant to frighten a girl. It seemed best to bring her here and get the business done with quickly."
"And what business is that?"
Ned put ice in his voice. The queen stepped forward. "You know full well, Stark, this girl of yours attacked my son, her and her butcher's boy. That animal of hers tried to tear his arm off."
"That's not true," Arya said loudly. "She just bit him a little. He was hurting Micah."
"Joff told us what happened," the queen says. "You and the butcher's boy beat him with clubs while you set your wolf on him."
"That's not how it was," Arya said, close to tears.
Ned put a hand on her shoulder.
"Yes, it is," Prince Joffrey insisted. "They all attacked me, and she threw Lion's Tooth in the river."
Ned noticed that he did not so much as glance at Arya as he spoke.
"Liar," Arya yelled.
"Shut up," the prince yelled back.
"Enough,"
the king roared, rising from his seat, his voice thick with irritation. Silence fell. He glared at Arya through his thick beard.
"Now, child, you will tell me what happened. Tell it all, and tell it true. It is a great crime to lie to a king."
Then he looked over at his son.
"And when she is done, you will have your turn. Until then, hold your tongue."
As Arya began her story, Ned heard the door open behind him. He glanced back and saw Vey and Poole enter with Sansa. They stood quietly at the back of the hall as Arya spoke. When she got to the part where she threw Joffrey's sword in the middle of the trident, Renly Baratheon began to laugh. The king bristled. "Sir Barristan, escort my brother from the hall before he chokes." Lord Renly stifled his laughter. "My brother is too kind. I can find the door myself." He bowed to Joffrey. "Perchance later you'll tell me how a 9-year-old girl, the size of a wet rat, managed to disarm you with a broom-handle and throw your sword in the river." As the door swung shut behind him, Ned heard him say, "Lion's tooth," and guffaw once more. Prince Joffrey was pale as he began his very different version of events. When his son was done talking, the king rose heavily from his seat, looking like a man who wanted to be anywhere but here.
"What in all the seven hells am I supposed to make of this? He says one thing, she says another."
"They were not the only ones present," Ned said. "Sansa, come here." Ned had heard her version of the story the night Arya had vanished. He knew the truth. "Tell us what happened." His eldest daughter stepped forward hesitantly. She was dressed in blue velvets trimmed with white, a silver chain around her neck. Her thick auburn hair had been brushed until it shone. She blinked at her sister, then at the young prince.
"I don't know," she said tearfully, looking as though she wanted to bolt. "I don't remember. Everything happened so fast I didn't see."
"You rotten!"
Arya shrieked. She flew at her sister like an arrow, knocking Sansa down to the ground, pummeling her.
"Liar! Liar! Liar! Liar!"
"Arya, stop it!" Ned shouted. Jorah pulled her off her sister, kicking. Sansa was pale and shaking as Ned lifted her back to her feet. "Are you hurt?" he asked, but she was staring at Arya, and she did not seem to hear. "The girl is as wild as that filthy animal of hers," Cersei Lannister said. "Robert, I want her punished."
"Seven hells," Robert swore. "Cersei, look at her, she's a child. What would you have me do? Whip her through the streets? Damn it, children, fight! It's over. No lasting harm was done."
The queen was furious. "Joff will carry those scars for the rest of his life." Robert Baratheon looked at his eldest son.
"So he will. Perhaps they will teach him a lesson. Ned, see that that daughter of yours is disciplined. I will do the same with my son."
"Gladly, your grace," Ned said with vast relief. Robert started to walk away, but the queen was not done. "And what of the direwolf?" she called after him. "What of the beast that savaged your son?" The king stopped, turned back, frowned.
"Oh, I'd forgotten about the damn wolf."
Ned could see Arya tense in Jorah's arms. Jorah spoke up quickly. "We found no trace of the direwolf, your grace." Robert did not look unhappy.
"No, so be it."
The queen raised her voice. 100 golden dragons to the man who brings me its skin."
"A costly pelt," Robert grumbled. "I want no part of this woman. You can damn well buy your furs with Lannister gold."
The queen regarded him coolly. "I had not thought you so niggardly. The king I'd thought to wed would have laid a wolfskin across my bed before the sun went down." Robert's face darkened with anger.
"That would be a fine trick without a wolf."
"We have a wolf," Cersei Lannister said. Her voice was very quiet, but her green eyes shone with triumph. It took them all a moment to comprehend her words, but when they did, the king shrugged irritably.
"As you will. Have Sir Ilyen see to it."
"Robert, you cannot mean this," Ned protested. The king was in no mood for more argument.
"Enough, Ned. I will hear no more. A direwolf is a savage beast.
Sooner or later it would have turned on your girl the same way the other did on my son. Get her a dog. She'll be happier for it."
That was when Sansa finally seemed to comprehend. Her eyes were frightened as they went to her father.
He doesn't mean Lady, does he?" She saw the truth on his face. "No," she said. "No, not Lady. Lady didn't bite anybody. She's good." "Lady wasn't there," Arya shouted, angry. "Leave her alone." "Stop them," Sansa pleaded. "Don't let them do it, please. Please, it wasn't Lady, it was Nymeria. Arya did it. You can't, it wasn't Lady. Don't let them hurt Lady. I'll make her be good, I promise, I promise." She started to cry. All Ned could do was take her in his arms and hold her while she wept. He looked across the room at Robert, his old friend, closer than any brother. "Please, Robert, for the love you bear me, for the love you bore my sister, please." The king looked at them for a long moment, then turned his eyes on his wife. "Damn you, Cersei," he said with loathing. Ned stood, gently disengaging himself from Sansa's grasp. All the weariness of the past 4 days had returned to him. "Do it yourself, then, Robert," he said in a voice cold and sharp as steel. "At least have the courage to do it yourself." Robert looked at Ned with flat, dead eyes and left without a word, his footsteps heavy as lead. Silence filled the hall. "Where is the direwolf?" Cersei Lannister asked when her husband was gone. Beside her, Prince Joffrey was smiling. "The beast is chained up outside the gatehouse, Your Grace," Sir Barristan Selmy answered reluctantly. "Send for Ilion Payne." "No," Ned said. "Jorry, take the girls back to their rooms and bring me ice." The words tasted of bile in his throat, but he forced them out. "If it must be done, I will do it." Cersei Lannister regarded him suspiciously. "You, Stark? Is this some trick? Why would you do such a thing?" They were all staring at him, but it was Sansa's look that cut. "She is of the North. She deserves better than a butcher." He left the room with his eyes burning and his daughter's wails echoing in his ears, and found the direwolf pup where they chained her. Ned sat beside her for a moment. "Lady," he said, tasting the name. He had never paid much attention to the names the children had picked, but looking at her now, he knew that Sansa had chosen well. She was the smallest of the litter, the prettiest, the most gentle and trusting. She looked at him with bright golden eyes, and he ruffled her thick grey fur. Shortly, Jorry brought him ice. When it was over, he said, "Choose 4 men and have them take the body north. Bury her at Winterfell." "All that way?" Jorry said, astonished. "All that way," Ned affirmed. "The Lannister woman shall never have this skin." He was walking back to the tower to give himself up to sleep at last, when Sandor Clegane and his riders came pounding through the castle gates back from the hunt. There was something slung over the back of his destrier, a heavy shape wrapped in a bloody cloak. "No sign of your daughter, Hand," the hound rasped down. "But the Dane was not wholly wasted. We got her little pet." He reached back and shoved the burden off, and it fell with a thud in front of Ned. Bending, Ned pulled back the cloak, dreading the words he would have to find for Arya. But it was not Nymeria after all. It was the butcher's boy, Micah, his body covered in dried blood. He had been cut almost in half from shoulder to waist by some terrible blow struck from above.
"You rode him down?"
Ned said. The hound's eyes seemed to glitter through the steel of that hideous dog's head helm.
"He ran." He looked at Ned's face and laughed. "But not very fast."
Jamie. Lord Tywin Lannister had entered the city on a stallion, his enameled crimson armor polished and gleaming, bright with gems and goldwork. He left it in a tall wagon draped with crimson banners, with six silent sisters riding attendants on his bones. The funeral procession departed King's Landing through the Gate of the Gods, wider and more splendid than the Lion Gate. The choice felt wrong to Jaime. His father had been a lion, that no one could deny, but even Lord Tywin never claimed to be a god. An honor guard of 50 knights surrounded Lord Tywin's wagon, crimson pennons fluttering from their lances. The lords of the West followed close behind them. The winds snapped at their banners, making their charges dance and flutter. As he trotted up the column, Jaime passed boars, badgers, and beetles, a green arrow and a red ox, crossed halberds, crossed spears, a tree-cat, a strawberry, a maunch, four sunbursts counter-changed. Lord Brax was wearing a pale grey doublet slashed with cloth of silver, an amethyst unicorn pinned above his heart. Lord Jast was armoured in black steel, three gold lion's heads inlaid on his breastplate. The rumours of his death had not been far wrong to look at him. Wounds and imprisonment had left him a shadow of the man he'd been. Lord Bainfort had weathered the battle better and looked ready to return to war at once. Plum wore purple, Prester, ermine, Morland, russet and green, but each had donned a cloak of crimson silk in honour of the man they were escorting home. Behind the lords came 100 crossbowmen and 300 men-at-arms, and crimson flowed from their shoulders as well. In his white cloak and white scale armour, Jaime felt out of place amongst that river of red. Nor did his uncle make him more at ease. "Lord Commander," Sir Kevin said, when Jaime trotted up beside him at the head of the column, "does Her Grace have some last command for me?" "I am not here for Circe." A drum began to beat behind them, slow, measured, funereal. "Dead," it seemed to say. "Dead, dead. I came to make my farewells. He was my father. And hers. I am not Circe. I have a beard and she has breasts. If you are still confused, Nuncle, count our hands. Circe has two." "Both of you have a taste for mockery," his uncle said. "Spare me your japes, sir. I have no taste for them." "As you will. This is not going as well as I might have hoped. Circe would have wanted to see you off, but she has many pressing duties." Sir Kevin snorted. "So do we all. How fares your king?" His tone made the question a reproach. "Well enough," Jaime said defensively. "Balon Swan is with him during the mornings. A good and valiant knight." Once that went without saying when men spoke of those who wore the white cloak. "No man can choose his brothers," Jaime thought. "Give me leave to pick my own men, and the King's Guard will be great again." Put that baldly, though, it sounded feeble. An empty boast from a man the realm called Kingslayer, a man with shit for honor. Jaime let it go. He had not come to argue with his uncle. "Sir," he said, "you need to make your peace with Circe." "Are we at war? No one told me." Jaime ignored that. Strife between Lannister and Lannister can only help the enemies of our house. "If there is strife, it will not be my doing. Circe wants to rule. Well and good, the realm is hers. All I ask is to be left in peace. My place is a Dari with my son. The castle must needs be restored, the lands planted and protected." He gave a bark of bitter laughter. "And your sister has left me little else to occupy my time. I had as well see Lancel wed. His bride has grown impatient waiting for us to make our way to Dari." His widow from the twins. His cousin Lancel was riding 10 yards behind them. With his hollow eyes and dry white hair, he looked older than Lord Jast. Jaime could feel his phantom fingers itching at the sight of him. "Fucking Lancel and Osmond, Kettle Black and Moonboy, for all I know." He had tried to speak with Lancel more times than he could count, but never found him alone. If his father was not with him, some septon was. He may be Kevin's son, but he has milk in his veins. Tyrion was lying to me. His words were meant to wound. Jaime put his cousin from his thoughts and turned back to his uncle. Will you remain at Tarry after the wedding? For a while, mayhaps. Sandor Clegane is raiding along the Trident, it would seem. Your sister wants his head. It may be that he has joined Dondarrion. Jaime had heard about salt pans. By now half the realm had heard. The raid had been exceptionally savage. Women raped and mutilated, children butchered in their mother's arms, half the town put to the torch. Randall Tarly is at Maidenpool. Let him deal with the outlaws. I would sooner have you go to Riverrun. Sir Davin has command there. The Warden of the West. He has no need of me. Lancel does. As you say, uncle. Jamie's head was pounding to the same beat as the drum. Dead, dead, dead. You would do well to keep your knights around you. His uncle gave him a cool stare. Is that a threat, sir? A threat? The suggestion took him aback. A caution. I only meant Sandor is dangerous. I was hanging outlaws and robber knights when you were still shitting in your swaddling clothes. I am not like to go off and face Clegane and Dondarrion by myself, if that is what you fear, sir. Not every Lannister is a fool for glory. Why, uncle, I believe you are talking about me. Adam Marbrand could deal with these outlaws just as well as you. So could Brax, Bainfort, Plum, any of these others. But none would make a good king's hand. Your sister knows my terms. They have not changed. Tell her that the next time you are in her bedchamber. Sir Kevin put his heels into his courser and galloped ahead, putting an abrupt end to their conversation. Jaime let him go, his missing sword hand twitching. He had hoped against hope that Circe had somehow misunderstood, but plainly that was wrong. He knows about the two of us, about Tommen and Myrcella, and Circe knows he knows. Sir Kevin was a Lannister of Casterly Rock. He could not believe that she would ever do him harm, but I was wrong about Tyrion. Why not about Circe? When sons were killing fathers, what was there to stop a niece from ordering an uncle slain? An inconvenient uncle who knows too much. Though perhaps Circe was hoping that the Hound might do her work for her. If Sandor Clegane cut down Sir Kevin, she would not need to bloody her own hands. And he will if they should meet. Kevin Lannister had once been a stout man with a sword, but he was no longer young, and the Hound. The column had caught up to him. As his cousin rode past, flanked by his two septons, Jaime called out to him, "Lancel, cuz, I wanted to congratulate you upon your marriage. I only regret that my duties do not permit me to attend. His grace must be protected." "And will be. Still, I hate to miss your bedding. It is your first marriage, and her second, I understand. I'm sure my lady will be pleased to show you what goes where." The bawdy remark drew a laugh from several nearby lords and a disapproving look from Lancel's septons. His cousin squirmed uncomfortably in the saddle. "I know enough to do my duty as a husband, sir." "That's just the thing a bride wants on her wedding night," said Jaime. "A husband who knows how to do his duty." A flush crept up Lancel's cheeks. "I pray for you, cousin, and for Her Grace the Queen. May the crone lead her to her wisdom, and the warrior defend her." "Why would Circe need the warrior? She has me." Jaime turned his horse about, his white cloak snapping in the wind. The imp was lying. Circe would sooner have Robert's corpse between her legs than a pious fool like Lancel. "Tyrion, you evil bastard! You should have lied about someone more likely." He galloped past his Lord Father's funeral wain toward the city in the distance. The streets of King's Landing seemed almost deserted as Jaime Lannister made his way back to the Red Keep atop Aegon's High Hill. The soldiers who had crowded the city's gambling dens and pot shops were largely gone now. Garland the Gallant had taken half the Tyrell strength back to Highgarden, and his Lady Mother and Grandmother had gone with him. The other half had marched south with Mace Tyrell and Mathis Rowan to invest Storm's End. As for the Lannister host, 2,000 seasoned veterans remained encamped outside the city walls, awaiting the arrival of Paxter Redwine's fleet to carry them across Blackwater Bay to Dragonstone. Lord Stannis appeared to have left only a small garrison behind him when he sailed north, so 2,000 men would be more than sufficient, Cersei had judged. The rest of the Westermen had gone back to their wives and children to rebuild their homes, plant their fields, and bring in one last harvest. Cersei had taken Tommen round their camps before they marched to let them cheer their little king. She had never looked more beautiful than she did that day, with a smile on her lips and the autumn sunlight shining on her golden hair. Whatever else one might say about his sister, she did know how to make men love her when she cared enough to try. As Jaime trotted through the castle gates, he came upon 2 dozen knights riding at a quintain in the outer yard. "Something else I can no longer do," he thought. A lance was heavier and more cumbersome than a sword, and swords were proving trial enough. He supposed he might try holding the lance with his left hand, but that would mean shifting his shield to his right arm. In a tilt, a man's foe was always to the left. A shield on his right arm would prove about as useful as nipples on his breastplate. "No, my jousting days are done," he thought as he dismounted. But all the same, he stopped to watch a while. Sir Tallard the Tall lost his mount when the sandbag came around and thumped him in the head. Strongbore struck the shield so hard he cracked it. Kenos of Case finished the destruction. A new shield was hung for Sir Dermot of the Rainwood. Lambert Turnberry only struck a glancing blow, but Beardless John Betley, Humphrey Swift, and Alan Stackspear all scored solid hits, and Red Ronnet Connington broke his lance clean. Then the Knight of Flowers mounted up and put the others all to shame. Jousting was three-quarters horsemanship, Jaime had always believed. Sir Loras rode superbly and handled the lance as if he'd been born holding one, which no doubt accounted for his mother's pinched expression. He puts the point just where he means to put it, and seems to have the balance of a cat. Perhaps it was not such a fluke that he unhorsed me. It was a shame that he would never have the chance to try the boy again. He left the men to their sport. Cersei was in her solar in Maegor's Holdfast, with Tommen and Lord Merryweather's dark-haired Meerish wife. The three of them were laughing at Grand Maester Pycelle. "Did I miss some clever jape?" Jaime said as he shoved through the door. "Oh, look," purred Lady Merryweather. "Your brave brother has returned, Your Grace." "Most of him." The Queen was in her cups, Jaime realized. Of late, Cersei always seemed to have a flagon of wine to hand, she who had once scorned Robert Baratheon for his drinking. He misliked that, but these days he seemed to mislike everything his sister did. "Grand Maester," she said, "share the tidings with the Lord Commander, if you would." Pycelle looked desperately uncomfortable. "There has been a bird," he said, "from Stokeworth. Lady Tander sends word that her daughter Lollys has been delivered of a strong, healthy son. And you will never guess what they have named the little bastard, brother." "They wanted to name him Tywin, I recall." "Yes, but I forbade it. I told Felice that I would not have our father's noble name bestowed upon the ill-gotten spawn of some pig-boy and a feeble-witted sow. Lady Stokeworth insists the child's name was not her doing," Grandmaester Pycelle put in. Perspiration dotted his wrinkled forehead. "Lollys's husband made the choice, she writes. This man, Bronn, he... It would seem that he..." "Tyrion," ventured Jaime. "He named the child Tyrion." The old man gave a tremulous nod, mopping at his brow with the sleeve of his robe. Jaime had to laugh. "There you are, sweet sister. You have been looking everywhere for Tyrion, and all the time he's been hiding in Lollys's womb." "Droll. You and Bronn are both so droll. No doubt the bastard is sucking on one of Lolly's Lackwit's dugs even as we speak, whilst this sellsword looks on, smirking at his little insolence." "Perhaps this child bears some resemblance to your brother," suggested Lady Merryweather. "He might have been born deformed or without a nose." She laughed a throaty laugh. "We shall have to send the darling boy a gift," the Queen declared. "Won't we, Tommen? We could send him a kitten." "A lion cub," said Lady Merryweather. to rip his little throat out, her smile suggested. I had a different sort of gift in mind, said Circe. A new stepfather, most like. Jamie knew the look in his sister's eye. He had seen it before, most recently on the night of Tommen's wedding, when she burned the Tower of the Hand. The green light of the wildfire had bathed the face of the watchers, so they looked like nothing so much as rotting corpses, a plaque of gleeful ghouls. But some of the corpses were prettier than the others. Even in the baleful glow, Circe had been beautiful to look upon. She'd stood with one hand on her breast, her lips parted, her green eyes shining. She is crying, Jamie had realized, but whether it was from grief or ecstasy he could not have said. The sight had filled him with disquiet, reminding him of Aerys Targaryen and the way a burning would arouse him. A king has no secrets from his king's guard. Relations between Aerys and his queen had been strained during the last years of his reign. They slept apart and did their best to avoid each other during the waking hours. But whenever Aerys gave a man to the flames, Queen Rhaella would have a visitor in the night. The day he burned his mace and dagger hand, Jaime and John Darry had stood at guard outside her bedchamber whilst the king took his pleasure. You're hurting me, they had heard Rhaella cry through the oaken door. You're hurting me! In some queer way, that had been worse than Lord Chelstead's screaming. We are sworn to protect her as well, Jamie had finally been driven to say. We are, Darry allowed, but not from him. Jamie had only seen Rhaella once after that, the morning of the day she left for Dragonstone. The queen had been cloaked and hooded as she climbed inside the royal wheelhouse that would take her down Aegon's High Hill to the waiting ship, but he heard her maids whispering after she was gone. They said the queen looked as if some beast had savaged her, clawing at her thighs and chewing on her breasts. A crowned beast, Jamie knew. By the end, the mad king had become so fearful that he would allow no blade in his presence, save for the swords his Kingsguard wore. His beard was matted and unwashed, his hair a silver-gold tangle that reached his waist, his fingernails cracked yellow claws 9 inches long. Yet still the blades tormented him, the ones he could never escape, the blades of the Iron Throne. His arms and legs were always covered with scabs and half-healed cuts. Let him be king over charred bones and cooked meat, Jamie remembered, studying his sister's smile. Let him be the king of ashes. Your Grace, he said, might we have a private word? As you wish. Tommen, it is past time you had your lesson for the day. Go with the Grand Maester. Yes, Mother, we are learning about Baelor the Blessed. Lady Merryweather took her leave as well, kissing the queen on both cheeks. Shall I return for supper, Your Grace? I shall be very cross with you if you do not. Jamie could not help but note the way the Meerish woman moved her hips as she walked. Every step is a seduction. When the door closed behind her, he cleared his throat and said, First these kettle blacks, then Kyburn, now her. It's a queer menagerie you are keeping these days, sweet sister. I am growing very fond of Lady Taena. She amuses me. She is one of Marjorie Tyrell's companions, Jamie reminded her. She's informing on you to the little queen. Of course she is. Circe went to the sideboard to fill her cup anew. Marjorie was thrilled when I asked her leave to take Taena on as my companion. You should have heard her. She will be a sister to you, as she's been to me. Of course you must have her. I have my cousins and my other ladies. Our little queen does not want me to be lonely. If you know she is a spy, why take her on? Marjorie is not half so clever as she thinks. She has no notion what a sweet serpent she has in that Meerish slut. I use Taena to feed the little queen what I want her to know. Some of it is even true. Circe's eyes were bright with mischief, and Taena tells me everything Maid Marjorie is doing. Does she? How much do you know about this woman? I know she is a mother with a young son that she wants to rise high in this world. She will do whatever is required to see that he does. Mothers are all the same. Lady Merryweather may be a serpent, but she is far from stupid. She knows I can do more for her than Marjorie, so she makes herself useful to me. You would be surprised at all the interesting things she's told me. What sort of things? Circe sat beneath the window. Did you know that the Queen of Thorns keeps a chest of coins in her wheelhouse? Old gold from before the conquest. Should any tradesman be so unwise as to name a price in golden coins, she pays him with hands from Highgarden, each half the weight of one of our dragons. What merchant would dare complain of being cheated by Mace Tyrell's lady mother? She sipped her wine and said, "Did you enjoy your little ride?" Our uncle remarked upon your absence. Our uncle's remarks do not concern me. They should. You could make good use of him. If not at River Run or the Rock, then in the north against Lord Stannis. Father always relied upon Kevin when... Roose Bolton is our warden of the north. He will deal with Stannis. Lord Bolton is trapped below the Neck, cut off from the north by the Iron Men at Moot Cailin. Not for long. Bolton's bastard son will soon remove that little obstacle. Lord Bolton will have 2,000 Freys to augment his own strength under Lord Walder's sons, Hostine and Ennis. That should be more than enough to deal with Stannis and a few thousand broken men. Sir Kevin will have his hands full at Derry, teaching Lancel how to wipe his arse. Father's death has unmanned him. He is an old, done man. Davin and Damian will serve us better. They'll suffice. Jamie had no quarrel with his cousins. You still require a hand, however. If not our uncle, who? His sister laughed. Not you. Have no fear on that count. Perhaps Tainer's husband. His grandfather was hand under Ares. The Horn of Plenty hand. Jamie remembered Owen Merryweather well enough. An amiable man, but ineffectual. As I recall, he did so well that Ares exiled him and seized his lands. Robert gave them back. Some, at least. Tainer would be pleased if Orton could recover the rest. Is this about pleasing some meerish whore? Here I thought it was about governing the realm. I govern the realm. Seven, save us all you do. His sister liked to think of herself as Lord Tywin with teats, but she was wrong. Their father had been as relentless and implacable as a glacier, where Circe was all wildfire, especially when thwarted. She had been giddy as a maiden when she learned that Stannis had abandoned Dragonstone, certain that he had finally given up the fight and sailed away to exile. When word came down from the north that he had turned up again at the wall, her fury had been fearful to behold. She does not lack for wits, but she has no judgment and no patience. You need a strong hand to help you. A weak ruler needs a strong hand, as Ares needed father. A strong ruler requires only a diligent servant to carry out his orders. She swirled her wine. Lord Halline might suit. He would not be the first pyromancer to serve as the king's hand. No, I killed the last one. There is talk that you mean to make Aurain Waters the master of ships. Has someone been informing on me? When he did not answer, Circe tossed her hair back and said, Waters is well suited to the office. He has spent half his life on ships. Half his life? He cannot be more than 20. 22, and what of it? Father was not even 21 when Aerys Targaryen named him Hand. It is past time Tommen had some young men about him in place of all these wrinkled greybeards. Aurain is strong and vigorous. Strong and vigorous and handsome, Jamie thought. She's been fucking Lancel and Osmond Kettleblack and Moonboy for all I know. The Paxter Redwine would be a better choice. He commands the largest fleet in Westeros.
Arane Waters could command a skiff, but only if you bought him one.
You are a child, Jamie. Redwine is Tyrell's bannerman and nephew to that hideous grandmother of his. I want none of Lord Tyrell's creatures on my council.
Tommen's council, you mean?
You know what I mean.
Too well. I know that Arane Waters is a bad idea, and Hallein is a worse one. As for Qyburn, God be good, Circe, he rode with Vargo Hote. The Citadel stripped him of his chain. The grey sheep. Qyburn has made himself most useful to me, and he is loyal, which is more than I can say of mine own kin. The crows will feast upon us all if you go on this way, sweet sister. Circe, listen to yourself. You are seeing dwarfs in every shadow and making foes of friends. Uncle Kevin is not your enemy. I am not your enemy. Her face twisted in fury. I begged for your help. I went down on my knees to you and you refused me. My vows did not stop you slaying Ares. Words are wind. You could have had me, but you chose a cloak instead. Get out. Sister, get out, I said. I am sick of looking at that ugly stump of yours. Get out. To speed him on his way, she heaved her wine cup at his head. She missed, but Jamie took the hint. Evenfall found him sitting alone in the common room of White Sword Tower, with a cup of Dornish red and the white book. He was turning pages with the stump of his sword hand when the Knight of Flowers entered, removed his cloak and sword belt and hung them on a wall peg next to Jamie's. "I saw you in the yard today," said Jamie. "You rode well."
"Better than well, surely."
Sir Loras poured himself a cup of wine and took a seat across the half-moon table.
A more modest man might have answered, "My lord is too kind," or "I had a good mount." The horse was adequate, and my lord is as kind as I am modest.
Loras waved at the book.
"Lord Renly always said that books were for maesters. This one is for us. The history of every man who has ever worn a white cloak is written here. I have glanced at it. The shields are pretty. I prefer books with more illuminations. Lord Renly owned a few with drawings that would turn a septon blind." Jamie had to smile.
"There's none of that here, sir, but the histories will open your eyes. You would do well to know about the lives of those who went before."
"I do. Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, Sir Ryam Redwine, the Great Heart, Barristan the Bold,
Gawain Corbray, Alan Connington, the Demon of Dari, aye. You will have heard of Lucamore Strong as well."
"Sir Lucamore the Lusty?"
Sir Loras seemed amused.
"Three wives and 30 children, was it? They cut his cock off. Shall I sing the song for you, my lord?"
"And Sir Terence Toyne?
Abetted the king's mistress and died screaming. The lesson is, men who wear white breeches need to keep them tightly laced."
"Giles Greycloak, Orivel the Open-Handed."
"Giles was a traitor, Orivel a coward. Men who shamed the white cloak. What is my lord suggesting?"
"Little and less. Don't take offence where none was meant, sir." "How about Long Tom Costain?"
Sir Loras shook his head. "He was a Kingsguard knight for 60 years. "When was that?"
"I've never..."
"Sir Donald of Duskendale, then?"
"I may have heard the name, but..."
"Addison Hill, the White Owl, Michael Mertens, Geoffrey Norcross. They call him Never Yield. Red Robert Flowers. What can you tell me of them?"
"Flowers is a bastard name, so is Hill."
"Yet both men rose to command the Kingsguard. Their tales are in the book. Roland Darkin is in here too. The youngest man ever to serve in the Kingsguard, until me. He was given his cloak on a battlefield and died within an hour of donning it."
"He can't have been very good."
"Good enough. He died, but his king lived. A lot of brave men have worn the white cloak. Most have been forgotten."
"Most deserve to be forgotten.
The heroes will always be remembered. The best. The best and the worst. So one of us is like to live in song. And a few who were a bit of both. Like him. He tapped the page he had been reading. Who? Solaris craned his head around to see. 10 black pellets on a scarlet field. I do not know those arms. They belonged to Criston Cole, who served the first Viserys and the second Aegon. Jaime closed the white book. They called him Kingmaker.
Sansa. A new gown? She said, as wary as she was astonished.
More lovely than any you've worn, my lady,
the old woman promised. She measured Sansa's hips with a length of knotted string.
All silk and Moorish lace with satin linings. You will be very beautiful. The queen herself has commanded it.
Which queen? Marjorie was not yet Joff's queen, but she had been Renly's. Or did she mean the Queen of Thorns, or...
The Queen Regent, to be sure.
Queen Cersei?
None other. She has honoured me with her custom for many a year.
The old woman laid her string along the inside of Sansa's leg.
Her Grace said to me that you are a woman now, and should not dress like a little girl. Hold out your arm.
Sansa lifted her arm. She needed a new gown, that was true. She had grown 3 inches in the past year, and most of her old wardrobe had been ruined by the smoke when she'd tried to burn her mattress on the day of her first flowering.
"Your bosom will be as lovely as the Queen's,"
the old woman said, as she looped her string around Sansa's chest.
"You should not hide it so."
The comment made her blush. Yet the last time she'd gone riding, she could not lace her jerkin all the way to the top, and the stable boy gaped at her as he helped her mount. Sometimes she caught grown men looking at her chest as well, and some of her tunics were so tight she could scarce breathe in them. "What colour will it be?" she asked the seamstress.
"Leave the colours to me, my lady. You will be pleased, I know you will. You shall have small clothes and hose as well, kirtles and mantles and cloaks, and all else befitting a lovely young lady of noble birth."
"Will they be ready in time for the king's wedding?"
"Oh, sooner, much sooner. Her Grace insists. I have 6 seamstresses and 12 apprentice girls, and we have set all other work aside for this. Many ladies will be cross with us, but it was the Queen's command."
"Thank Her Grace kindly for her thoughtfulness," Sansa said politely. "She is too good to me."
"Her Grace is most generous,"
the seamstress agreed, as she gathered up her things and took her leave. But why, Sansa wondered when she was alone. It made her uneasy. "I'll wager this gown is Marjorie's doing somehow, or her grandmother's." Marjorie's kindness had been unfailing, and her presence changed everything. Her ladies welcomed Sansa as well. It had been so long since she had enjoyed the company of other women, she had almost forgotten how pleasant it could be. Lady Leonette gave her lessons on the high harp, and Lady Janna shared all the choice gossip. Mary Crane always had an amusing story, and little Lady Bulwer reminded her of Arya, though not so fierce. Closest to Sansa's own age were the cousins Eleanor, Arla, and Megha, Tyrells from junior branches of the house. "Roses from lower on the bush," quipped Eleanor, who was witty and willowy. Megha was round and loud, Arla shy and pretty. But Eleanor ruled the three by right of womanhood. She was a maiden flowered, whereas Megha and Arla were mere girls. The cousins took Sansa into their company as if they had known her all their lives. They spent long afternoons doing needlework and talking over lemon cakes and honeyed wine, played at tiles of an evening, sang together in the castle sept, and often one or two of them would be chosen to share Marjorie's bed, where they would whisper half the night away. Arla had a lovely voice, and when coaxed would play the wood harp and sing songs of chivalry and lost loves. Megha couldn't sing, but she was mad to be kissed. She and Alla played a kissing game sometimes, she confessed, but it wasn't the same as kissing man, much less a king. Sansa wondered what Mega would think about kissing the Hound, as she had. He'd come to her the night of the battle, stinking of wine and blood. He kissed me and threatened to kill me and made me sing him a song. "King Joffrey has such beautiful lips," Mega gushed, oblivious. "Oh, poor Sansa, how your heart must have broken when you lost him. Oh, how you must have wept." "Joffrey made me weep more often than you know," she wanted to say. But Butterbumps was not at hand to drown out her voice, so she pressed her lips together and held her tongue. As for Eleanor, she was promised to a young squire, a son of Lord Ambrose. They would be wed as soon as he won his spurs. He had won her favour in the Battle of the Blackwater, where he'd slain a Moorish crossbowman and a Mullendore man-at-arms.
"Alan said her favour made him fearless," said Mega. "He says he shouted her name for his battle cry. Isn't that ever so gallant? Some day I want some champion to wear my favour and kill 100 men."
Eleanor told her to hush, but looked pleased all the same. "They are children," Sansa thought. "They are silly little girls, even Eleanor. They've never seen a battle. They've never seen a man die. They know nothing. Their dreams were full of songs and stories, the way hers had been before Joffrey cut her father's head off. Sansa pitied them. Sansa envied them. Marjorie was different, though, sweet and gentle, yet there was a little of her grandmother in her, too. The day before last, she'd taken Sansa hawking. It was the first time she'd been outside the city since the battle. The dead had been burned or buried, but the Mudgate was scarred and splintered, where Lord Stannis's rams had battered it, and the hulls of smashed ships could be seen along both sides of the Blackwater, charred masts poking from the shallows like gaunt black fingers. The only traffic was the flat-bottom ferry that took them across the river, and when they reached the Kingswood, they found a wilderness of ash and charcoal and dead trees. But the waterfowl teemed in the marshes along the bay, and Sansa's Merlin brought down 3 ducks while Marjorie's Peregrine took a heron in full flight. "Willis has the best birds in the 7 kingdoms," Marjorie said when the 2 of them were briefly alone. "He flies an eagle sometimes. You will see, Sansa." She took her by the hand and gave it a squeeze. "Sister?" Sister. Sansa had once dreamt of having a sister like Marjorie, beautiful and gentle, with all the world's graces at her command. Arya had been entirely unsatisfactory as sisters went. "How can I let my sister marry Joffrey?" she thought, and suddenly her eyes were full of tears. "Marjorie, please," she said, "you mustn't." It was hard to get the words out. "You mustn't marry him. He's not like he seems. He's not. He'll hurt you." "I shouldn't think so," Marjorie smiled confidently. "It's brave of you to warn me, but you need not fear. Joffrey's spoiled and vain, and I don't doubt that he's cruel, as you say, but father forced him to name Loras to his king's guard before he would agree to the match. I shall have the finest knight in the 7 kingdoms protecting me night and day, as Prince Aemon protected Nerys. So our little lion had best behave, hadn't he?" She laughed and said, "Come, sweet sister, let's race back to the river. It will drive our guards quite mad." And without waiting for an answer, she put her heels into a horse and flew. "She is so brave," Sansa thought, galloping after her, and yet her doubts still gnawed at her. Sir Loras was a great knight, all agreed, but Joffrey had other king's guard, and gold cloaks, and red cloaks besides, and when he was older he would command armies of his own. Aegon the Unworthy had never harmed Queen Nerys, perhaps for fear of their brother, the Dragon Knight. But when another of his king's guards fell in love with one of his mistresses, the king had taken both their heads. "Sir Loras is a Tyrell," Sansa reminded herself.
That other knight was only a Toyn. His brothers had no armies, no way to avenge him but with swords. Yet the more she thought about it all, the more she wondered. Geoff might restrain himself for a few turns, perhaps as long as a year, but soon or late he will show his claws, and when he does, the realm might have a second Kingslayer, and there would be war inside the city, as the men of the Lion and the men of the Rose made the gutters run red. Sansa was surprised that Margaery did not see it too. She is older than me. She must be wiser. And her father, Lord Tyrell, he knows what he is doing, surely. I am just being silly. When she told Sir Dontus that she was going to Highgarden to marry Willis Tyrell, she thought he would be relieved and pleased for her. Instead, he had grabbed her arm and said, "You cannot," in a voice as thick with horror as with wine. "I tell you, these Tyrells are only Lannisters with flowers. I beg of you, forget this folly. Give your Florian a kiss, and promise you'll go ahead as we have planned. The night of Geoffrey's wedding, that's not so long, wear the silver hairnet and do as I told you, and afterwards we'll make our escape." He tried to plant a kiss on her cheek. Sansa slipped from his grasp and stepped away from him. "I won't. I can't. Something would go wrong. When I wanted to escape, you wouldn't take me, and now I don't need to." Dontus stared at her stupidly. "But the arrangements are made, sweetling. The ship to take you home. The boat to take you to the ship. Your Florian did it all for his sweet Junkle." "I'm sorry for all the trouble I put you to," she said, "but I have no need of boats and ships now."
"But it's all to see you safe."
"I will be safe in Highgarden. Willis will keep me safe."
"But he does not know you,"
Dontus insisted.
"And he will not love you. Junkle, Junkle, open your sweet eyes. These Tyrells care nothing for you. It's your claim they mean to wed."
"My claim?" She was lost for a moment.
"Sweetling," he told her, "you are heir to Winterfell."
He grabbed her again, pleading that she must not do this thing, and Sansa wrenched free and left him swaying beneath the heart tree. She had not visited the Guardswood since. But she had not forgotten his words either. The heir to Winterfell, she would think, as she lay abed at night. "It's your claim they mean to wed." Sansa had grown up with three brothers. She never thought to have a claim. But with Bran and Rickon dead, it doesn't matter. There's still Rob. He's a man grown now, and soon he'll wed and have a son. Anyway, Willis Tyrell will have Highgarden. What would he want with Winterfell? Sometimes she would whisper his name into her pillow just to hear the sound of it. Willis, Willis, Willis. Willis was as good a name as Loras, she supposed. They even sounded the same. A little. What did it matter about his leg? Willis would be Lord of Highgarden, and she would be his lady. She pictured the two of them sitting together in a garden with puppies in their laps, or listening to a singer strum upon a lute while they floated down the Mander on a pleasure barge. "If I give him sons, he may come to love me." She would name them Eddard and Brandon and Rickon, and raise them all to be as valiant as Sir Loras, and to hate Lannisters too. In Sansa's dreams, her children looked just like the brothers she had lost. Sometimes there was even a girl who looked like Arya. She could never hold the picture of Willis long in her head, though. Her imaginings kept turning him back into Sir Loras, young and graceful and beautiful. "You must not think of him like that," she told herself, "or else he may see the disappointment in your eyes when you meet. And how could he marry you then, knowing it was his brother you loved?" Willis Tyrell was twice her age, she reminded herself constantly, and lame as well, and perhaps even plump and red-faced like his father. But calmly or no, he might be the only champion she would ever have. Once she dreamed it was still her marrying Joff, not Marjorie, and on their wedding night he turned into the headsman, Ilion Payne. She woke trembling. She did not want Marjorie to suffer as she had, but she dreaded the thought that the Tyrells might refuse to go ahead with the wedding. I warned her, I did, I told her the truth of him.